all for a wife. That's what they ask. Why didn't you just go to Patni?
Alsana smiled ruefully, shook her head, while Samad made a pretense of calm, filling their metal kettle with water and slamming it down on the stove.
And that is a beautiful lungi you have on, Samad Mia,
she said bitterly, nodding in the direction of his blue toweling jogging suit topped off with Poppy's L.A. Raiders baseball cap. Samad said,
The difference is what is in here,
not looking at her, thumping just below his left breastbone.
You say you are thankful we are in England? That's because you have swallowed it whole. I can tell you, those boys would have a better life back home than they ever... Samad Mia, don't even begin. It will be over my dead body that this family moves back to a place where our lives are in danger. Clara tells me about you. She tells me how you have asked her strange things. What are you plotting, Samad? I hear from Zenith all about this life insurance. Who is dying? What can I smell? I tell you, it will be over my dead body.
But if you are already dead, Alsie, shut up! Shut up! I am not mad! You are trying to drive me mad! I phoned Ardashir, Samad. He is telling me you have been leaving work at 11:30. It is 2 in the morning. I am not mad!
No, it is worse. Your mind is diseased. You call yourself a Muslim.
Alsana whipped round to face Samad, who was trying to concentrate his attention on the whistling steam emerging from the kettle.
No, Samad. Oh, no. Oh, no. I don't call myself anything. I don't make claims. You call yourself a Muslim. You make the deals with Allah. You are the one he will be talking to, Kamashar. You, Samad Mia, you!
Second round. Samad slapped Alsana. Alsana right-hooked him in the stomach and then followed up with a blow to the left cheekbone. She then made a dash to the back door, but Samad caught her by the waist, rugby-tackled her, dragged her down and elbowed her in her coccyx. Alsana, being heavier than Samad, knelt up, lifting him, flipped him over and dragged him out into the garden, where she kicked him twice as he lay on the floor, 2 short, fierce jabs to the forehead. But the rubber-cushioned sole did little damage, and in a moment he was on his knees again. They made a grab for each other's hair, Samad determined to pull until he saw blood. But this left Alsana's knee free, and it connected swiftly with Samad's crotch, forcing him to release the hair and swing a blind flyer meant for her mouth, but catching her ear. Around this time, the twins emerged half awake from their beds and stood at the long glass kitchen window to watch the fight, while the neighbor's security lights came on, illuminating the Iqbal garden like a stadium.
Abba, said Majid, after surveying the state of play for a moment. Definitely Abba.
Cha man, no way, said Millat, blinking in the light. I bet you 2 orange lollies Amma's going to kick the shit out of him.
Ooh, cried the twins in unison, as if it were a firework display, and then, ah!
Alsana had just ended the fight with a little help from the garden rake.
Now maybe some of us who have work in the morning can get a decent night's kip, bloody packies, shouted a neighbor.
A few minutes later, because they always held each other after these fights, a hug somewhere between affection and collapse, Samad came in from the garden, still mildly concussed, and said,
Go to bed,
before brushing a hand through each son's thick black hair. As he reached the door, he stopped.
You'll thank me,
he said, turning to Majid, who smiled faintly, thinking maybe Abba was going to get him that chemistry set after all.
You'll thank me in the end. This country is no good. We tear each other apart in this country.
Then he walked up the stairs and phoned Poppy Burt Jones, waking her up to tell her there would be no more kisses in the afternoon. No more guilty walks. No more furtive taxis. end of affair. Maybe all the Iqbals were prophets, because Alsana's nose for trouble was more right than it had ever been. Public decapitations, families cremated in their sleep, hanging bodies outside the Kashmir gate, people stumbling around dazed, missing pieces of themselves. Body parts taken from Muslim by Sikh, from Sikh by Hindu. Legs, fingers, noses, toes and teeth, teeth everywhere scattered throughout the land, mingling with the dust. 1,000 people had died by 4th November, when Alsana emerged from under the bathwater to hear the crackling voice of our man in Delhi, telling her about it from the top of the medicine cabinet. Terrible business. But as Samad saw it, some of us have the luxury of sitting in the bath and listening to the foreign news, while some of us have a living to make, and an affair to forget, and a child to abduct. He squeezed into the white flares, checked the air ticket, phoned Archie to go over the plan, and left for work. On the tube, there was a youngish, prettyish girl, dark, Spanish-looking, mono-browed, crying. Just sitting opposite him in a pair of big, pink leg warmers, crying quite openly. Nobody said anything. Nobody did anything. Everybody hoped she was getting off at Kilburn. But she kept on like that, just sitting, crying. West Hampstead, Finchley Road, Swiss Cottage, St. John's Wood. Then at Bond Street, she pulled a photo of an unpromising-looking young man out of her rucksack, showed it to Samad and some of the other passengers.
Why he leave? He break my heart. Neil, he say his name. Neil, Neil, Neil.
At Charing Cross, end of the line, Samad watched her cross the platform and get the train going straight back to Willesden Green. Romantic, in a way. The way she said, Neil, as if it were a word bursting at the seams with past passion, with loss. That kind of flowing, feminine misery. He had expected something similar of Poppy somehow. He had picked up the phone, expecting gentle, rhythmic tears, and later on, letters, maybe, scented and stained. And in her grief, he would have grown, as Neil was probably doing at this moment. Her grief would have been an epiphany, bringing him one step closer to his own redemption. But instead, he had got only, "Fuck you! You fucking fuck!"
"Told you," said Shiva, shaking his head and passing Samad a basket of yellow napkins to be shaped like castles. "I told you not to fuck with that business, didn't I? Too much history there, man. You see, it ain't just you she's angry with, is it?"
Samad shrugged and began on the turrets.
"No, man. History, history. It's all brown man leaving English woman. It's all Nehru saying see ya to Madame Britannia."
Shiva, in an effort to improve himself, had joined the Open University.
"It's all complicated. Complicated shit. It's all about pride. 10 quid says she wanted you as a servant boy, as a wala, peeling the grapes."
"No," protested Samad. "It wasn't that way. This is not the Dark Ages, Shiva. This is 1984.
"Shows how much you know. From what you've told me, she is a classic case, mate. Classic."
"Well, I have other concerns now," muttered Samad,
privately calculating that his children would by now be safely tucked in at the Joneses' sleepover, that it was 2 more hours before Archie would need to wake Majid, leaving Millat to sleep on.
"Family concerns."
"No time,"
cried Ardashir, who had crept up from behind, imperceptibly as ever, to examine the battlements of Samad's castles.
"No time for family concerns, cousin. Everyone's concerned. Everyone's trying to get their family out of that mess back home. I myself am forking out 1,000 big ones for a ticket for my big mouth sister. But I still have to come to work,
I still have to get on with things. Busy night tonight, cousin,
called Ardashir, as he exited the kitchen to pace around the restaurant floor in a black tuxedo.
Don't let me down.
It was the busiest night in the week, Saturday, the night when the crowds come in waves. Pre-theater, post-theater, post-pub, post-club. The first polite and conversational, the second humming show tunes, the third rowdy, the fourth wide-eyed and abusive. The theater crowds were naturally the favorite ones of the waiters. They were even-tempered and tipped big and inquired after the geography of the food, its Eastern origin, its history, all of which would be happily fabricated by the young waiters, whose furthest expedition east was the one they made daily, back home to Whitechapel, Smithfields, the Isle of Dogs, or rendered faithfully and proudly by the elders in black biro on the back of a pink napkin.
I'll bet she is, was the show at the National these past few months, a rediscovered mid-50s musical set in the 30s.
It was about a rich girl who runs away from her family and meets a poor boy on the road, who is himself off to fight the civil war in Spain. They fall in love. Even Samad, who had no particular ear for a tune, picked up enough discarded programs and heard enough tables burst into song to know most of the songs. He liked them. In fact, they took his mind off the drudgery. Even better, tonight there was sweet relief from worrying whether Archie would manage to get Majid outside the palace at 1 a.m. on the dot. He murmured them along with the rest of the kitchen in a kind of working rhythm as they chopped and marinated, sliced and crushed.
I've seen the Paris Opera and the wonders of the East.
Samad Mia, I'm looking for the Raja mustard seeds.
Spent my summers by the Nile and my winters on the Piste.
Mustard seeds! I think I saw Muhammad with them.
I've had diamonds, rubies, furs, and velvet capes.
Accusations, accusations! I have seen no mustard seeds!
I've had Howard Hughes peel me a grape.
I'm sorry, Shiva. If the old man doesn't have them, then I haven't seen them.
But what does it mean without love?
Then what are these?
Shiva walked over from his place next to Chef and picked up a packet of mustard seeds by Samad's right elbow.
Come on, Sam, get it together. Head in the clouds this evening.
I'm sorry, I have a lot on my mind.
That lady friend of yours, eh?
Keep your voice down, Shiva.
They tell me I'm spoilt. A rich broad who means trouble.
Sang Shiva in the strangest of Hindified transatlantic accents.
Oi, oi, my chorus. But whatever love I'm given, I pay it back double.
Shiva grabbed a small aquamarine vase and sang his big finale into its upturned end.
But no amount of money will make my honey mine.
You should take that advice, Samad Mia,
said Shiva, who was convinced Samad's recent remortgage was funding his illicit affair.
It's good advice.
A few hours later, Ardashir appeared once more through the swing doors, breaking up the singing to deliver his second phase pep talk.
Gentlemen, gentlemen, that is more than enough of that. Now listen up, it's 10:30. They've seen the show, they're hungry. They got only one pitiful tub of ice cream in the interval and plenty of Bombay gin, which, as we all know, brings on the need for curry. And that, gentlemen, is where we come in. Two tables of 15 just came in and sat at the back. Now, when they ask for water, what do you do? What do you do, Ravind?
Ravind was brand new. Nephew of the chef. 16. Nervy.
You tell them, no, Ravind, even before you speak, what do you do?
Ravind bit his lip.
I don't know, Ardashir. You shake your head,
said Ardashir, shaking his head,
simultaneous with a look of concern and fear for their well-being.
Ardashir demonstrated the look.
And then you say?
Water does not help the heat, sir.
But what helps the heat, Ravind? What will aid the gentleman with the burning sensation he is presently feeling?
More rice, Ardashir.
And?
Ravind looked stumped and began to sweat. Samad, who had been belittled by Ardashir too many times to enjoy watching someone else play the victim, leant over to whisper the answer in Ravind's clammy ear. Ravind's face lit up in gratitude.
More naan bread, Ardashir.
Yes, because it soaks up the chili and more importantly, water is free and naan bread is £1.20. Now, cousin, said Ardashir, turning to Samad and waggling a bony finger, how will the boy learn? Let the boy answer for himself next time. You have your business. A couple of ladies on table 12 have requested the head waiter specifically to be served only by him. So?
Requested me? But I thought I might stay in the kitchen this evening. Besides, I cannot be requested like some personal butler. There is too much to do. That is not policy, cousin.
And at this moment, Samad feels panicky. His thoughts are so taken up with the 1 a.m. abduction, with the prospect of splitting his twins, that he does not trust himself with hot plates and steaming bowls of dal, with the spitting fat of clay oven chicken, with all the dangers that accost a one-handed waiter. His head is full of his sons. He is half in dream this evening. He has once again bitten every nail beyond the cuticle and is fast approaching the translucent high moons, the bleeding hubs. He is saying, he hears himself saying,
Ardashir, I have a million things to do here in the kitchens. And why should...
And the answer comes, because the head waiter is the best waiter and naturally they tipped me, us, for their privilege. No quibbling, please, cousin. Table 12, Samad Mia.
And perspiring lightly, throwing a white towel over his left arm, Samad begins tunelessly to hum the showstopper as he pushes through the doors.
What won't a guy do for a girl? How sweet the scent, how huge the pearl.
It is a long walk to table 12. Not in distance, it is only 20 meters in distance, but it is a long walk through the thick smells and the loud voices and the demands, through the cries of Englishmen, past table 2 where the ashtray is full and must be cupped by another ashtray, lifted silently and switched for the new ashtray with perfect insouciance, stopping at table 4 where there is an unidentifiable dish that was not ordered, debating with table 5 who wished to be joined with table 6 no matter the inconvenience, and table 7 wants egg-fried rice whether or not it is a Chinese dish. And table 8 wobbles and more wine, more beer. It is a long walk if you are to negotiate the jungle, attending to the endless needs and needless ends, the desires, the demands of the pink faces that strike Samad now as pit helmet-wearing gentlemen, feet up on the table with guns across their laps, as tea-slurping ladies on verandas, cooling themselves under the breeze of the brown boys who beat the ostrich feathers.
What lengths won't he travel? How many hits of the gravel?
By Allah, how thankful he is! Yes, madam. One moment, madam. How gladdened by the thought that Majid at least, will, in a matter of 4 hours, be flying east from this place and its demands, its constant cravings, this place where there exists neither patience nor pity, where the people want what they want now, right now.
We've been waiting 20 minutes for the vegetables,
expecting their lovers, their children, their friends, and even their gods to arrive at little cost and in little time, just as table 10 expect their tandoori prawns.
At the auction of her choosing, how many Rembrandts, Klimts, de Koonings?
These people who would exchange all faith for sex and all sex for power, who would exchange fear of God for self-pride, knowledge for irony, a covered, respectful head for a long, strident shock of orange hair. It is Poppy at table 12. It is Poppy Burt Jones. And just the name would be enough right now, for he is at his most volatile, Samad. He is about to split his own sons in two,
like that first nervous surgeon wielding his clumsy spit-wet knife over the clotted skin of the twins of Siam. Just the name would be enough to explode his mind. The name alone is a torpedo heading for a tiny fishing boat, blowing his thoughts out of the water. But it is more than the name. The echo of a name spoken by some thoughtless fool or found at the bottom of an old letter, it is Poppy Burt Jones herself in the freckled flesh, sitting cold and determined with her sister, who seems, like all siblings of those we have desired, an uglier, misfeatured version.
"Say something, then," says Poppy abruptly, fiddling with a Marlboro packet. "No witty rejoinder. No crap about camels or coconuts. Nothing to say?"
Samad doesn't have anything to say. He merely stops humming his tune, inclines his head at exactly the correct deferential angle, and puts the nib of his pen preparedly to paper. It is like a dream.
"All right, then,"
Poppy is saying tartly, looking Samad up and down, lighting up a fag.
"Have it your way. Right. To start with, we'll have lamb samosas and the yogurt, whatchamacallit. And for the main?"
The shorter, plainer, oranger, snub-nosed sister is saying.
"Two lamb donsock and rice with chips. Please, waiter."
At least Archie is right on time. Right year, right date, right hour. 1984, 5th November, 1 a.m. Outside the restaurant, dressed in a long trench coat, standing in front of his Vauxhall, one hand tickling some spanking new Pirelli tires, the other pulling hard on a fag like Bogart, or a chauffeur, or Bogart's chauffeur. Samad arrives, clasps Archie's right hand in his own, and feels the coldness of his friend's fingers, feels the great debt he owes him. Involuntarily, he blows a cloud of frozen breath into his face.
"I won't forget this, Archibald," he is saying. "I won't forget what you do for me tonight, my friend."
Archie shuffles about awkwardly.
"Sam, before you, there's something I have to..."
But Samad is already reaching for the door, and Archie's explanation must follow the sight of three shivering children in the back seat like a limp punchline.
"They woke up, Sam. They were all sleeping in the same room. A sleepover, like..."
"Nothing I could do. I just put coats over their pajamas. I couldn't risk Clara hearing. I had to bring them."
Irie asleep, curled up with her head on the ashtray and her feet resting on the gearbox. But Millat and Majid reaching out for their father gleefully, pulling at his flares, chucking him on the chin.
"Hey, Abba, where are we going, Abba? To a secret disco party? Are we really?"
Samad looks severely at Archie. Archie shrugs.
"We're going on a trip to an airport. To Heathrow."
"Wow!"
"And then when we get there, Majid... Majid..."
It is like a dream. Samad feels the tears before he can stop them. He reaches out to his eldest son by 2 minutes and holds him so tight to his chest that he snaps the arm off his glasses.
"And then Majid is going on a trip with Auntie Zeenat."
"Will he come back?"
It is Millat.
"It would be cool if he didn't come back."
Majid prizes himself from his father's headlock.
"Is it far? Will I be back in time for Monday? Only I've got to see how my photosynthesis is for science. I took two plants, put one in the cupboard and one in the sunlight, and I've got to see, Abba. I've got to see which one..."
Years from now, even hours after that plane leaves, this will be history that Samad tries not to remember, that his memory makes no effort to retain. A sudden stone submerged, false teeth floating silently to the bottom of a glass.
"Will I get back for school, Abba?"
"Come on," says Archie, solemnly from the front seat. "We've got to get cracking if we're going to make it." You'll be in a school on Monday, Majid. I promise. Now sit back in your seats. Go on. For Abba. Please.
Samad closes the car door and crouches to watch his twin sons blow their hot breath onto the window. He puts his one hand up, applying a false touch to their lips. Raw pink against the glass. Their saliva mingling in the grimy condensation.
9. Mutiny. To Alsana's mind, the real difference between people was not color, nor did it lie in gender, faith, their relative ability to dance to a syncopated rhythm, or open their fists to reveal a handful of gold coins. The real difference was far more fundamental. It was in the earth. It was in the sky. You could divide the whole of humanity into two distinct camps, as far as she was concerned, simply by asking them to complete a very simple questionnaire, of the kind you would find in Woman's Own on a Tuesday. A. Are the skies you sleep under likely to open up for weeks on end? B. Is the ground you walk on likely to tremble and split? C. Is there a chance, and please tick the box, no matter how small that chance seems, that the ominous mountain casting a midday shadow over your home might one day erupt with no rhyme or reason? Because if the answer is yes to one or all of these questions, then the life you lead is a midnight thing, always a hair's breadth from the witching hour. It is volatile, it is threadbare, it is carefree in the true sense of that term, it is light, losable like a keyring or a hair clip. And it is lethargy. Why not sit all morning, all day, all year, under the same cypress tree, drawing the figure of 8 in the dust? More than that, it is disaster. It is chaos. Why not overthrow a government on a whim? Why not blind the man you hated? Why not go mad, go gibbering through the town like a loon, waving your hands, tearing your hair? There's nothing to stop you. Or rather, anything could stop you any hour, any minute. That feeling, that's the real difference in a life. People who live on solid ground, under safe skies, know nothing of this. They are like the English POWs in Dresden, who continued to pour tea and dress for dinner even as the alarms went off, even as the city became a towering ball of fire. Born of a green and pleasant land, a temperate land, the English have a basic inability to conceive of disaster, even when it is man-made. It is different for the people of Bangladesh, formerly East Pakistan, formerly India, formerly Bengal. They live under the invisible finger of random disaster, of flood and cyclone, hurricane and mudslide. Half the time, half their country lies underwater. Generations wiped out as regularly as clockwork. Individual life expectancy, an optimistic 52. And they are coolly aware that when you talk about apocalypse, when you talk about random death en masse, well, they are leading the way in that particular field. They will be the first to go, the first to slip Atlantis-like down to the seabed when the pesky polar ice caps begin to shift and melt. It is the most ridiculous country in the world, Bangladesh. It is God's idea of a really good wheeze, his stab at black comedy. You don't need to give out questionnaires to Bengalis. The facts of disaster are the facts of their lives. Between Alsana's sweet 16th birthday, 1971, for example, and the year she stopped speaking directly to her husband, 1985. More people died in Bangladesh, more people perished in the winds and the rain than in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and Dresden put together. 1 million people lost lives that they had learned to hold lightly in the first place. And this is what Alsana really held against Samad, if you want the truth, more than the betrayal, more than the lies, more than the basic facts of a kidnap, that Majid should
learned to hold his life lightly.
Even though he was relatively safe up there in the Chittagong Hills, the highest point of that low-lying flatland country, still she hated the thought that Majid should be as she had once been, holding on to a life no heavier than a paisa coin, wading thoughtlessly through floods, shuddering underneath the weight of black skies. Naturally, she became hysterical. Naturally, she tried to get him back. She spoke to the relevant authorities. The relevant authorities said things like,
"To be honest, love, we are more worried about them coming in."
Or, "To tell you the truth, if it was your husband who arranged the trip, there's not a great deal that we..."
So she put the phone down. After a few months, she stopped ringing. She went to Wembley and Whitechapel in despair and sat in the houses of relatives for epic weekends of weeping and eating and commiserations. But her gut told her that though the curry was sound, the commiserations were not all they seemed. For there were those who were quietly pleased that Alsana Iqbal, with her big house and her blacky-white friends and her husband who looked like Omar Sharif and her son who spoke like the Prince of Wales, was now living in doubt and uncertainty like the rest of them, learning to wear misery like old familiar silk. There was a certain satisfaction in it. Even as Zeenat, who never revealed her role in the deed, reached over the chair arm to take Alsana's hand in her sympathetic claws.
"Oh, Alsi, I just keep thinking what a shame it is that he had to take the good one. He was so very clever and so beautifully behaved. You didn't have to worry about drugs and dirty girls with that one. Only the price of spectacles with all that reading."
Oh, there was a certain pleasure. And don't ever underestimate people. Don't ever underestimate the pleasure they receive from viewing pain that is not their own, from delivering bad news, watching bombs fall on television, from listening to stifled sobs from the other end of a telephone line. Pain by itself is just pain. But pain plus distance can equal entertainment, voyeurism, human interest, cinema verite, a good belly chuckle, a sympathetic smile, a raised eyebrow, disguised contempt. Alsana sensed all these and more at the other end of her telephone line as the calls flooded in, 28th May, 1985, to inform her of, to offer commiserations for, the latest cyclone.
"Alsi, I simply had to call. They say there are so many bodies floating in the Bay of Bengal."
"I just heard the latest on the radio. 10,000.
"And the survivors are floating on rooftops, while the sharks and crocodiles snap at their heels." "It must be terrible, Alsi, not knowing, not being sure."
For 6 days and six nights, Alsana did not know, was not sure. During this period, she read extensively from the Bengali poet Rabindranath Tagore and tried hard to believe his assurances. "Night's darkness is a bag that bursts with the gold of the dawn."
But she was, at heart, a practical woman and found poetry no comfort. For those 6 days, her life was a midnight thing, a hair's breadth from the witching hour. But on the seventh day came light. The news arrived that Majid was fine, suffering only a broken nose, delivered by a vase which had fallen from its perilous station on a high shelf in a mosque, blown over in the first breath of the first winds. And keep an eye on that vase, please. It is the same vase that will lead Majid by the nose to his vocation. It was only the servants, having 2 days earlier taken a secret supply of gin and piled into the family's dilapidated transit van on a pleasure trip to Dhaka, who were now floating belly up in the Jamuna River, as fish-finned silver stared up at them, pop-eyed and bemused.
Samad was triumphant. "You see, he'll come to no harm in Chittagong. Even better news, he was in a mosque. Better he break his nose in a mosque than in a Kilburn fight. It is exactly as I had hoped. He is learning the old ways. Is he not learning the old ways?
Alsana thought for a moment. Then she said,
Maybe, Samad Mia.
What do you mean, maybe?
Maybe, Samad Mia. Maybe not.
Alsana had decided to stop speaking directly to her husband. Through the next 8 years, she would determine never to say yes to him, never to say no to him, but rather to force him to live like she did, never knowing, never being sure, holding Samad's sanity to ransom, until she was paid in full with the return of her number one son, eldest by 2 minutes, until she could once more put a chubby hand through his thick hair. That was her promise. That was her curse upon Samad, and it was exquisite revenge. At times, it very nearly drove him to the brink, to the kitchen knife stage, to the medicine cabinet, but Samad was the kind of person too stubborn to kill himself if it meant giving someone else satisfaction. He hung on in there, Alsana turning over in her sleep, muttering,
Just bring him back, Mr. Idiot. If it's driving you nutso, just bring my baby back.
But there was no money to bring Majid back, even if Samad had been inclined to wave the white dhoti. He learned to live with it. It got to the point where if somebody said yes or no to Samad in the street or in the restaurant, he hardly knew how to respond. He had come to forget what those two elegant little signifiers meant. He never heard them from Alsana's lips. Whatever the question in the Iqbal house, there would never again be a straight answer.
Alsana, have you seen my slippers?
Possibly, Samad Mia.
What time is it?
It could be 3, Samad Mia. But Allah knows it could also be 4.
Alsana, where have you put the remote control?
It is as likely to be in the drawer, Samad Mia, as it is behind the sofa.
And so it went. Sometime after the May cyclone, the Iqbals received a letter from their elder son by 2 minutes, written in a careful hand on exercise paper and folded around a recent photograph. It was not the first time he had written, but Samad saw something different in this letter, something that excited him and validated the unpopular decision he had made. Some change of tone, some suggestion of maturity, of growing Eastern wisdom, and having read it carefully in the garden first, he took great pleasure in bringing it back to the kitchen and reading it aloud to Clara and Alsana, who were drinking peppermint tea.
Listen, here he says, Yesterday, grandfather hit Tamim, he is the houseboy, with a belt until his bottom was redder than a tomato. He said Tamim had stolen some candles. It's true, I saw him do it, and this was what he got for it. He says sometimes Allah punishes, and sometimes men have to do it. And it is a wise man who knows if it is Allah's turn or his own. I hope one day I will be a wise man. Do you hear that? He wants to be a wise man. How many kids in that school do you know who want to be wise men?
Maybe none, Samad Mia. Maybe all.
Samad scowled at his wife and continued.
And here where he talks about his nose, it seems to me that a vase should not be in such a silly place where it can fall and break a boy's nose. It should be somebody's fault, and somebody should be punished. But not a bottom smack unless they were small and not a grown-up, if they were younger than 12. When I grow up, I think I should like to make sure vases are not put in such silly places where they can be dangerous, and I would complain about other dangerous things too. By the way, my nose is fine now. See?
Clara frowned.
See what? Clearly he disapproves of iconography in the mosque. He dislikes all heathen, unnecessary, dangerous decoration. A boy like that is destined for greatness, isn't he?
Maybe, Samad Mia. Maybe not.
Maybe he'll go into government. Maybe the law, suggested Clara. Rubbish! My son is for God, not men. He is not fearful of his duty. He is not fearful to be a real Bengali, a proper Muslim. Here he tells me the goat in the photograph is dead. I helped to kill the goat, Abba, he says. It kept on moving some time after we had split it in two. Is that a boy who is fearful?
It clearly became incumbent upon someone to say no. Clara said it with little enthusiasm and reached for the photograph Samad was passing her. There was Majid, dressed in his customary grey, standing next to the doomed goat with the old house behind him.
Oh, look at his nose! Look at the break! He's got a Roman nose now. He looks like a little aristocrat, like a little Englishman. Look, Millet!
Clara put the photo under Millet's smaller, flatter nose.
You two don't look so much like twins anymore.
He looks, said Millet after a cursory glance, like a chief.
Samad, never au fait with the language of the Wilsden streets, nodded soberly and patted his son's hair.
It is good that you see the difference between you two boys, Millet, now rather than later.
Samad glared at Alsana as she spun an index finger in a circle by her temple, as she tapped the side of her head. Crazy nutso.
Others may scoff, but you and I know that your brother will lead others out of the wilderness. He will be a leader of tribes. He is a natural chief.
Millet laughed so loud at this, so hard, so uncontrollably, that he lost his footing, slipped on a washcloth, and broke his nose against the sink. Two sons, one invisible and perfect, frozen at the pleasant age of 9, static in a picture frame while the television underneath him spewed out all the shit of the 80s, Irish bombs, English riots, transatlantic stalemates, above which mess the child rose untouchable and unstained, elevated to the status of ever-smiling Buddha, imbued with serene Eastern contemplation, capable of anything,
a natural leader, a natural Muslim, a natural chief,
in short, nothing but an apparition. A ghostly daguerreotype, formed from the quicksilver of the father's imagination, preserved by the salt solution of maternal tears. This son stood silent, distant, and was presumed well, like one of Her Majesty's colonial island outposts, stuck in an eternal state of original naivety, perpetual prepubescence. This son Samad could not see. And Samad had long learned to worship what he could not see. As for the son he could see, the one who was under his feet and in his hair, well, it is best not to get Samad started up on that subject, the subject of the trouble with Millet, but here goes. He is the second son, late like a bus, late like cheap postage, the slow coach, the catch-up kid, losing that first race down the birth canal, and now simply a follower by genetic predisposition, by the intricate design of Allah, the loser of two vital minutes that he would never make up. Not in those all-seeing parabolic mirrors, not in those glassy globes of the Godhead, not in his father's eyes. Now, a more melancholy child than Millet, a more deep-thinking child, might have spent the rest of his life hunting these 2 minutes and making himself miserable, chasing the elusive quarry, laying it finally at his father's feet. But what his father said about him did not concern Millet all that much. He knew himself to be no follower, no chief, no wanker, no sellout, no fuckwit, no matter what his father said. In the language of the street, Millet was a rude boy, a bad man, at the forefront, changing image as often as shoes, sweet as, safe,
wicked, leading kids up hills to play football, downhill to rifle fruit machines, out of schools, into video shops. In Rocky Video, Millet's favorite haunt, run by an unscrupulous coke dealer, you got porn when you were 15, 18s when you were 11, and snuff movies under the counter for 5 quid. Here was where Millet really learnt about fathers. Godfathers, blood brothers, Pacino De Niro's, men in black who looked good, who talked fast, who never waited a motherfucking table, who had 2 fully functioning, gun-toting hands. He learned that you don't need to live under flood, under cyclone, to get a little danger. To be a wise man, you go looking for it. Aged 12, Millet went out looking for it. And though Willesden Green is no Bronx, no South Central, he found a little. He found enough. He was arsy and mouthy. He had his fierce good looks squashed tightly inside him like a jack-in-a-box set to spring aged 13, at which point he graduated from leader of zit-faced boys to leader of women. The Pied Piper of Willesden Green, smitten girls trailing behind him, tongues out, breast spurt, falling into pools of heartbreak, and all because he was the biggest and the baddest, living his young life in capitals. He smoked first. He drank first. He even lost it. It. Aged 13 and a half. Okay, so he didn't feel much or touch much. It was moist and confusing. He lost it without even knowing where it went. But he still lost it, because there was no doubt, none, that he was the best of the rest. On any scale of juvenile delinquency, he was the shining light of the teenage community, the don, the business, the dog's genitalia, a street boy, a leader of tribes. In fact, the only trouble with Millet was that he loved trouble. And he was good at it. Wipe that. He was great. Still, there was much discussion. At home, at school, in the various kitchens of the widespread Iqbal Begum clan, about the trouble with Millet. Mutinous Millet, aged 13, who farted in mosque, chased blondes and smelt of tobacco. And not just Millet, but all the children. Mujib, 14, criminal record for joyriding. Khandakar, 16, white girlfriend, wore mascara in the evenings. Dipesh, 15, marijuana. Khurshid, 18, marijuana and very baggy trousers. Khalida, 17, sex before marriage with Chinese boy. Bimal, 19, doing a diploma in drama. What was wrong with all the children? What had gone wrong with these first descendants of the great ocean crossing experiment? Didn't they have everything they could want? Was there not a substantial garden area? Regular meals? Clean clothes from Marks and Sparks? A-class, top-notch education? Hadn't the elders done their best? Hadn't they all come to this island for a reason? To be safe? Weren't they safe?
Too safe,
Samad explained, patiently consoling one or other weeping, angry ma or baba, perplexed an elderly dadu or dida.
They are too safe in this country. Acha. They live in big plastic bubbles of our own creation. Their lives all mapped out for them. Personally, you know, I would spit on St. Paul, but the wisdom is correct. The wisdom is really Allah's.
Put away childish things. How can our boys become men when they are never challenged like men, huh? No doubt about it. On reflection, sending Majid back was the best thing. I would recommend it.
At which point, the assembled weepers and mourners all look mournfully at the treasured picture of Majid and goat. They sit mesmerized, like Hindus waiting for a stone cow to cry, until a visible aura seems to emanate from the photo.
Goodness and bravery through adversity, through hell and high water. The true Muslim boy, the child they never had.
Pathetic as it was, Alsana found it faintly amusing. The tables having turned, no one weeping for her, everyone weeping for themselves and their children, for what the terrible 80s were doing to them both. These gatherings were like last-ditch political summits. They were like desperate meetings of government and church behind closed doors while the mutinous mob roamed wild on the streets, smashed windows. A distance was establishing itself, not simply between father-sons, old-young, born-there, born-here, but between those who stayed indoors and those who ran riot outside.
"Too safe, too easy," repeated Samad, as great-aunt Bibi wiped Majid lovingly with some Mr. Sheen. "A month back home would sort each and every one of them out."
But the fact was, Millat didn't need to go back home. He stood schizophrenic, one foot in Bengal and one in Wilsdon. In his mind, he was as much there as he was here. He did not require a passport to live in two places at once. He needed no visa to live his brother's life and his own. He was a twin after all. Alsana was the first to spot it. She confided to Clara,
"By God, they are tied together like a cat's cradle, connected like a seesaw. Push one end, other goes up. Whatever Millat sees, Majid saw, and vice versa."
And Alsana only knew the incidentals, similar illnesses, simultaneous accidents, pets dying continents apart. She did not know that while Majid watched the 1985 cyclone shake things from high places, Millat was pushing his luck along the towering wall of the cemetery in Fortune Green. That on 10th February 1988, as Majid worked his way through the violent crowds of Dhaka, ducking the random blows of those busy settling an election with knives and fists, Millat held his own against three sotted, furious, quick-footed Irishmen outside Biddy Mulligan's notorious Kilburn public house.
"Ah, but you are not convinced by coincidence. You want fact, fact, fact. You want brushes with the big man, with Black Hood and Scythe."
Okay, on the 28th of April, 1989, a tornado whisked the Chittagong kitchen up into the sky, taking everything with it except Majid, left miraculously curled up in a ball on the floor. Now, segue to Millat, 5,000 miles away, lowering himself down upon legendary sixth former Natalia Cavendish, whose body is keeping a dark secret from her. The condoms are unopened in a box in his back pocket, but somehow he will not catch it. Even though he is moving rhythmically now, up and in, deeper and sideways, dancing with death. 3 days. 15th October, 1987. Even when the lights went out and the wind was beating the shit out of the double glazing, Alsana, a great believer in the Oracle, that is, the BBC, sat in a nightie on the sofa, refusing to budge.
"If that Mr. Fish says it's okay, it's damn well okay. He's BBC, for God's sake."
Samad gave up. It was almost impossible to change Alsana's mind about the inherent reliability of her favored English institutions, amongst them Princess Anne, Blue Tack, Children's Royal Variety Performance, Eric Morecambe, Woman's Hour. He got the torch from the kitchen drawer and went upstairs, looking for Millat.
"Millat? Answer me, Millat. Are you there?"
"Maybe, Abba. Maybe not."
Samad followed the voice to the bathroom and found Millat chin-high in dirty pink soap suds, reading Viz.
"Ah, Dad, wicked! Torch! Shine it over here so I can read."
"Never mind that."
Samad tore the comic from his son's hands.
"There's a bloody hurricane blowing and your crazy mother intends to sit here until the roof falls in. Get out of the bath. I need you to go to the shed and find some wood and nails so that we can..."
"But Abba, I'm butt naked."
"Don't split the hairs with me. This is an emergency. I want you to..."
An almighty ripping noise, like something being severed at the roots and flung against a wall,
came from outside. 2 minutes later, and the family Iqbal was standing regimental in varying states of undress, looking out through the long kitchen window onto a patch in the lawn where the shed used to be. Millat clicked his heels 3 times and hammed it up with corner shop accent.
Oh me, oh my, there's no place like home, there's no place like home.
All right, woman, are you coming now?
Maybe, Samad Mia, maybe.
Damn it, I'm not in the mood for a referendum. We are going to Archibald's. Maybe they still have light. And there is safety in numbers. Both of you, get dressed. Grab the essentials, the life or death things, and get in the car.
Holding the car boot open against a wind determined to bring it down, Samad was first amused and then depressed by the items his wife and son determined essential life or death things. Millat, Born to Run album, Springsteen, poster of De Niro in You Talking to Me, scene from Taxi Driver, Betamax copy of Purple Rain, rock movie, shrink to fit Levi's 501, red tab, pair of black Converse baseball shoes, A Clockwork Orange book, Alsana, sewing machine, 3 pots of tiger balm, leg of lamb frozen, foot bath, Linda Goodman's Star Signs book, huge box of Beedi cigarettes, Divarjeet Singh in Moonshine Over Kerala musical video. Samad slammed the boot down.
No penknife, no edibles, no light sources, bloody great. No prizes for guessing which one of the Iqbals is the war veteran. Nobody even thinks to pick up the Quran. Key item in emergency situation, spiritual support. I am going back in there. Sit in the car and don't move a muscle.
Once in the kitchen, Samad flashed his torch around. Kettle, oven hob, teacup, curtain, and then a surreal glimpse of the shed sitting happy like a treehouse in next door's horse chestnut. He picked up the Swiss Army knife he remembered leaving under the sink, collected his gold-plated, velvet-fringed Quran from the living room, and was about to leave when the temptation to feel the gale, to see a little of the formidable destruction, came over him. He waited for a lull in the wind and opened the kitchen door, moving tentatively into the garden, where a sheet of lightning lit up a scene of suburban apocalypse. Oaks, cedars, sycamores, elms felled in garden after garden, fences down, garden furniture demolished. It was only his own garden, often ridiculed for its corrugated iron surround, treeless interior, and bed after bed of sickly-smelling herbs, that had remained relatively intact. He was just in the process of happily formulating some allegory regarding the bending eastern reed versus the stubborn western oak, when the wind reasserted itself, knocking him sideways and continuing along its path to the double glazing, which had cracked and exploded effortlessly, blowing glass inside, regurgitating everything from the kitchen out into the open air. Samad, a recently airborne colander resting on his ear, held his book tight to his chest and hurried to the car.
What are you doing in the driving seat?
Alsana held on to the wheel firmly and talked to Millat via the rearview mirror.
Will someone please tell my husband that I am going to drive? I grew up by the Bay of Bengal. I watched my mother drive through winds like these while my husband was poncing about in Delhi with a load of fairy college boys. I suggest my husband gets in the passenger seat and doesn't fart unless I tell him to.
Alsana drove at 3 miles an hour through the deserted, blacked-out high road, while winds of 110 miles per hour relentlessly battered the tops of the highest buildings.
England. This is meant to be. I moved to England so I wouldn't have to do this. Never again will I trust that Mr. Crab.
Amma, it's Mr. Fish. From now on, he's Mr. Crab to me, snapped Alsana with a dark look. BBC or no BBC?
the lights had gone out at Archie's. But the Jones household was prepared for every disastrous eventuality, from tidal wave to nuclear fallout.